The radio show for people who know the best part of the day is the night.
Late Night Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We have ways of making you talk.
Hello, dear listener. You have had the foresight, intuition and downright good luck to download Friday's Show 5's Best of Ian Lee podcast from everyone here at Talk Radio. And I have to say, Kath, it's a real effort not to say Talk Sport or BBC Three Counties, because they're both impregnated in my mind womb.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say either just then.
No, not at all. And I wouldn't. I'm getting better. I still want to say the old phone number as well. Whenever a call is finished, go, all right, thanks for that, Steve. Give us a call, 034.
Yeah.
So that end of the first week. How do you think it's gone?
Well,
be honest, but not too honest. In fact, don't be honest.
I think it went well. I think the first couple of shows we were really surprised, weren't we? Because people flipping loved us.
And then from Wednesday onwards, it was all downhill.
They got used to us, and
yeah.
Anyway,
this one's bound to be a good one because it's Good Friday, and why do they call it Good Friday? Because that's when they killed him.
It means like holy rather than.
Oh, well, why don't they call it Holy Friday? Why don't they call it Bad Friday? The Long Bad Friday, starring it was the Hoskins,
yeah.
Bob Hoskins and Charlie from Casualty is in that. I think he gets done in a shower, and I think it's Charlie. It's such a long time. I remember watching that film when I was about 9 on bootleg pirate Betamax video.
Gosh, I bet that was shocking.
It was a very shocking film for a 9-year-old to watch. But this was before. And it was not a video nasty, but this is before like video nasties came out and you could get that shiz and no one realised. They thought, well, because we can watch it at home, it must be okay. So kids were watching stuff like Driller Killer. And I didn't get to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I got to hear it as my parents watched it.
Both of those, though, without any certification, you would know, wouldn't you, from the titles?
But the 70s and the 80s are very, very different. My mum let me watch anything, but she wouldn't let me watch the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I was fascinated by it. And I heard them watching it. I love that film. It's one of my favourite films. I've not seen it for years. But I was like, when did that come out? Was that 81? I would have been about 8 or 9. And I remember being upstairs. And the last... Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh, it's genius. Tobe Hooper is a genius. The last 25 minutes is literally a woman screaming while a man in a leather mask made out of other people's faces revs a chainsaw. So for 25 minutes, it's... Literally, the last 25 minutes. And I heard that in my bed when I was 8 or 9 years old. Flipping heck. I was, like proper terror. And they had it on loud. Used to have TVs loud in the early 80s. Mm. So, on that bombshell, here's
our version of the Texas.
It's the last 25 minutes of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Have you got kids, Jamie?
7. Hello? I get that silence a lot.
How many have you got?
7.
Never!
Really?
Yep.
How many have you got?
7.
That's outrageous!
I've got the oldest one's 21 and she's doing really well, got a career going, and my youngest one is 5 months old.
Oh, mate, put it away! Why do you keep having kids, mate?
Do you know what? When I was a child, I used to help bring up my sister, talk to her, used to change nappies and...
Yeah.
I sort of always wanted to be a dad myself.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay, so, but I'm a dad, but I've got 2 and that's plenty!
Yeah, well, I did. After 2, I did say I was going to stop. And
you know what does it, yeah?
Forgot.
You know where that? You know, yeah. You know how they're made.
Well, I found out now. That's why I'm stopping.
Right. Okay. So. Now you've made the connection. It'll be easier for you to stop fathering children. 7. Flipping heck. Do you? When you read to your kid, do you read to your kids? Of course you do. You sound like a good dad.
Yeah, of course you do.
One of the great joys of being a dad or being a parent is sitting down and reading to the kids. I love it. Such a thrill. And
I love it.
There are times when I'm tired and grumpy, and the kids say, "Read to me, Daddy," and I go, "Oh no, I'm too tired." And then I catch myself. And I think, do you know what? They won't be asking this for much longer because the oldest can read himself now. Come here, boys. Come on, let's sit down.
It's
now,
brilliant.
When you read, do you do the voices?
Of course, you've got to do the voices.
See, I tend not to do the voices?
You've got to do the voices. I read Cat in the Hat to the kids the other day. Yeah. We all sat down and read Cat in the Hat. And I did it in that fast-paced style that Dr. Seuss...
Well, that's the speed. Speed. I'll do... Oh, I mix and I do the speed and I go very quiet sometimes. And then I do a thing that make my boys laugh is I'll read something very, very quietly, and then suddenly on the wrong word I go loud, and they are terrified, but they just wet themselves laughing. But the voices, and so all right,
I love the voices.
I haven't got a storybook on. Why would I have a storybook on me? I'm looking around for a storybook. So you do it. What I can't do is, and so the little old lady said, "Come here, young child," and then the boy said, "I'm not going near. What you talking about? Do you do all that?"
Yeah.
Oh, man. But then how do you remember whose voice does what? And sometimes, I will go to the break in a second, sometimes I don't know who's speaking, because it doesn't say until, like, after a couple of sentences, said the old lady. So I'll be doing the little boy's voice, and then it'll be the old lady, and it just confuses things.
You sort of scan ahead as you're reading the... doing the voice for that line. You kind of try and scan ahead for the next line.
Where were you trained? Is it RADA?
I think... Seven Kids is...
There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Jamie, you're an excellent sport, mate. I appreciate it. 0844 499 1000. Geeky Girl, have you ever used your karate skills in real life?
Hey, no, not that I can recall, no. But I did used to go to some Thai Jitsu class. That was like ninja stuff.
Hang on a second. Thai Jitsu.
Yeah, that's what they called it, but it was actually ninjutsu. But they called it Thai Jitsu for some reason.
Well, hang on a minute. You've been... Was it with the bloke called Gary? Friday, 7:30 to 9:30, only £2.50.
It was about that price, but...
Yeah, because you've been sold a pup there. Right, Thai Jitsu doesn't exist. That's like, what's that? Thai Bo. And there's a Thai Bo, right?
Which is, it's made up.
Thai Bo doesn't exist, right? They've got one word from one fitness thing and then a Bo from the Dukes of Hazzard, and they've put it together to make Thai Bo, right? That is not anything. And Thai Jitsu is not a thing. And also, they're not allowed, legally, they're not allowed to teach you the secrets of the ninja.
Well, maybe that's why they had to change the name. It was an extra layer of secretness. It might have been, you know, all the shadows.
I genuinely thought it was illegal to teach you the secrets of the ninja. I thought there was a law against it. And if anyone was found passing on the secrets for money, here's the best. You know what I know? The best ninja way to kill someone. And this is flipping brilliant, right? You're going to love this. No. Not snapping their neck.
We didn't learn to kill people.
This is the best ninja way, but it only works with people who sleep on their back. So I'm safe. Because I sleep on my side and on my front, right? So the person's asleep on their back, right? And you have to climb up in their eaves, which is where we get the phrase eavesdropping from. Thank you. You climb up in the eaves. That means like the roof for people who aren't as clever as me. And then you get a tiny thin bit of cotton, right? And you unwind it just above their face. So the end of the cotton is literally like half a cent. You've got to be so good at it because it's dark as well. Half a centimetre from their open mouth, right?
Then
you hold it there, and then you get the tiny phial of poison, and you have to put it, drop the poison on the bit of thread. So it just drops down, runs down the thread into the mouth. You wind the cotton up.
Oh.
And then they're dead. And there's no evidence, no evidence at all. Ninja murders with Henley.
See where the little bit of cotton's dangling.
Because you're a ninja, you've got ninja skills.
They don't have night vision goggles.
No, they train them. Flipping it, you claim to know the secrets of the ninja. They live underground for six. I'm actually getting angry now. They live underground for 6 months in complete darkness, so they can see in the dark and they can sense in the dark.
Blimey.
There's a brilliant film, right? And I can't remember. I think it's called... Right, after the first Godfather, there were a lot of people in it that went on to become household names. And they all got, like, their own film projects, right? Mm-hmm. And one of them... Was it Gene Hackman that was in... Was Gene Hackman in the Godfather? It was either Gene... No, it was James Caan. James Caan, that was it. James Caan's film that he was given after the Godfather... I think it was called Mafia versus Ninja, but I might be wrong.
What?
I might be confusing. It was him, and it was the short, fat guy from Rocky.
Just one ninja?
No, there's loads of ninjas, right?
Okay.
Right, guess who wins? So it's the ninja with their ninja skills versus James Caan, the short, fat guy from Rocky, and a few other mafiosa. Guess who wins?
What weaponry have they got?
Well, the ninjas have got all the weapons: the shuriken, the nunchucks. They've got all of the weapons at their disposal.
Have they got bulletproof vests on?
They don't have bulletproof vests.
I'm going to still go with the ninjas.
Yeah, no, the mafia beat the bejesus out of them. Seriously.
Oh.
And there's one ninja, right? There's a brilliant bit. I've got to try and find this film, right? There's a brilliant bit where a ninja, in all his glory, jumps out from behind some crates, behind the short, fat one from Rocky, right?
Hmm.
And the short, fat one from Rocky turns around, and the fella's like going, what? And the short, fat one from Rocky just makes a fist, punches him in the face, and he falls over into the sea and drowns.
That would never happen with
exactly.
a real ninja.
Exactly.
That's misrepresentation.
Yeah, it is.
Late Night, Ian Lee on Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
Ah, oh, it's an absolute pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome to the show Matt Haig. Evening, Matt.
Evening, Ian. Hello.
How you doing, mate? You're right?
I'm very well, actually. I've just had a nice, calming herbal tea, and I'm feeling quite nice.
What herbal teas are you going for at the moment? Because I'm off caffeine now.
I can't do caffeine. Sleep easy? I don't know what make it is, but sleep easy. I thought, well, as I'm going on radio, you know, perfect.
You don't want to sleep easy now. You want to sleep hard. No, hang on. You want to stay awake now.
True. Yes, I know. I might go quiet in about 2 minutes.
How long have you been off the caffeine for?
Years.
Really?
I can just about do alcohol. I can't do caffeine. I don't know why. I don't know why they legalise that stuff. It's crazy.
It's nuts. I haven't had a drink or a drug for about 12 years, but I do. I love coffee. And I remember a couple of years ago, we got this coffee from this kind of powdered coffee. Me and Kath were drinking it at work because we were doing a breakfast show. So we had a lot of coffee. And after about 3 days of drinking this, we were miserable. I mean, like, I was going home and crying, and we were just crashing. And it dawned on me, it was this particular coffee we were drinking. It was so strong that when we were, you know, we'd have two or three cups at 7 o'clock in the morning. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were coming down. We were jonesing. It was awful. And you're right, that stuff is, it's toxic stuff, coffee. But coffee in particular. Yeah. I know it's in other bits and pieces.
Yes. I mean, people swear by it, don't they? But they need it in the to get them through. They're addicted and they need it. But yeah, for me, if I had a coffee first thing in the morning, that'd be it. I'd be sort of seeing leprechauns for the rest of the day. It'd just be...
Now, Matt, it's so nice to talk to you. We have we met very briefly. I was having one of the worst days of my life. Bizarrely, I feel I can share this stuff with you. I just come from my therapist who told me that I was probably in the middle of a breakdown. And then I came and saw you and got a book signed and I was a little bit starstruck. So all in all, it was a very strange day. We'll talk about reasons to stay alive in a second, but I've got to ask you a question about the humans.
Right.
Because I read this. My wife bought it for me about maybe 2 years ago, I think, for Christmas. And I loved it. But I think I completely misunderstood it.
Okay.
In the same way that I misunderstood The Good Dinosaur, it turns out. I got the premise wrong for that. You know the asteroid, the meteor at the start of The Good Dinosaur?
Yes.
That's supposed to be the one that hits Earth and wipes out the dinosaur, but it misses.
Yes, it's a parallel universe.
You knew that. I didn't know that. I felt so stupid. In The Humans, which is brilliant, right, has he actually been taken over by an alien? Or I read it that he'd had a mental breakdown.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I do see it as a science fiction thing. I see it as like a metaphor, I suppose, for a breakdown, maybe. But I actually like it being, like, what's the word, a fable, where it is actually an alien. Yeah, I thought go the whole hog. My editor was like, no, it's got to be this sort of unreliable narrator who just thinks he's an alien. And then he sort of, you know, goes through therapy and realises he's not actually an alien. And I think, no, just make him an alien. And but weirdly, it's totally autobiographical because I was sort of writing about...
Oh.
I never thought I was an alien. But, you know, that feeling of depression, that feeling of being very sort of far away from people, and that sort of, you know, which lots and lots of people relate to. And I was just sort of putting that down. I thought, what is the sort of perfect way of expressing what those sort of mental health problems feel like? And I thought, an alien being.
It's a good book. Listen, I've often wanted to write a book, and I start and I haven't got the patience, and I haven't got the skills, and I haven't got the dedication. When you write something like The Humans, do you sit up bolt upright in your bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and go, I've got it right, the next one's going to be this guy and he's an alien? Or how do you come up with, this is a really dumb question, but I like my dumb questions, how do you come up with the stories, Matt?
How do I come up with a story? I don't have a clue. I mean, in most cases, one case, I wrote a children's book last year called A Boy Called Christmas, about Father Christmas as a boy. That literally, I was just ripping off my son, basically, who said, was Father Christmas ever a boy? And I thought, oh, yeah. Has an origin story for Father Christmas ever been done? No. So that was an obvious place. Often it's just like, yeah, I'd love those sort of eureka moments where you get it, but it's generally just a long, pained process of sitting at a Word document, sitting at your laptop, and just, I'm seen as quite fast as writers go, but I do one book a year. I still think that's pretty slow, really. I think compared to the amount of people working proper jobs, that's, pretty, you know, to write 70,000 words a year, that being your job, that's, you know. We all do that on Twitter and Facebook. Isn't it?
You do get distracted by Twitter a lot.
It's true. It is true. I'm trying to sort of limit the hours a day I have access to it. There's some app which blocks you from being on it.
Yeah.
My wife's getting pretty sort of heavy about it and saying, you cannot be on, you know, in daylight hours or whatever. But yes, I do. Twitter, I don't mind Facebook. I think Facebook's kind of like a family wedding, isn't it? But Twitter is just more like, it's quite intense. It's like a sort of techno club in Berlin or something, and everyone's sort of just very, you know, jaw clenchy, and I don't know, there's not much empathy and love going around sometimes. But that said, we kind of met there, didn't we?
We did, actually. That is a positive. I have met quite a few good people on Twitter and then, you know, spoken to them in the real world.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, for people who might be having a little bit of a hard time in life, whatever, it's a good way of finding sort of like minds, fellow sort of troubled souls or whatever.
It's also, though, a good way of finding complete and utter arses, because there are Twitter, I find, is kind of like crack, right? Whereas Facebook is more like smoking a joint. Twitter is like crack in that it's instant and it is very addictive, and it's very, all right, that, how many retweets did that get? I want more. I want to interact with that person. I want to follow that person. Why has that person stopped following me? And recently, I've been really lucky in that the last few months I've had, you know, because of all the stuff that happened at the other place, I've had a lot of affection and a lot of kindness shown to me on Twitter. And it's been really nice. But I'm guessing you're the same. I could have 100 people say, oh, you know, you're a really nice bloke. Well done. I wish you the best of luck. And one person saying, you're an idiot and you deserve everything you get.
Yeah.
And that's the one that sticks with me. And all of the others become irrelevant. It's that one that I carry around in my head at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's like the tiny little stone in your shoe, isn't it, that you're just noticing. And, yeah, all the time. And it's about things that if you were saying this to people across the table, they'd be totally fine about it. But people misinterpret things that get sent. And they imagine if you have a sort of, I don't know, over 1,000 followers, that you're some, you know, you can just take whatever you... But, no, I mean, I do moan about Twitter. I mean, I do spend a lot of time on Twitter, so... And I'm argumentative. I'm very argumentative. So if someone says something to me, I genuinely I don't really enjoy it, but I just find myself just arguing, and it's not healthy. But, I think it's designed to be like that. I think they deliberately...
It's not good, I think, it's not good, I don't think, for vulnerable people, because it is easy to... I blocked about 300 people, and then recently I unblocked them as an experiment, not the ones that threatened to kill me and my children. I kept those guys blocked. I thought maybe I wouldn't allow them back into my life. But I kind of unblocked everyone, and just... there are some unpleasant people. I mean, there's the fella that was after the Brussels attacks. I've got his tweet here because he's in the paper. I confronted a Muslim woman yesterday in Croydon. I asked her to explain Brussels. She said nothing to do with me. A mealy-mouthed reply. People really feel... I wasn't intending to talk to you about this at all. But people really feel that they can say what they want. And they can criticise creative people and artists and presenters and writers in a way... You know, if someone doesn't like my radio show, that's fine. But for someone to say, you're really rubbish, you deserve to get the sack, and I hope you never get a job again, which I've had, and I'm sure you've had similar as well. Yes. It's a really strange phenomenon that people feel comfortable doing that.
Yes, and that is a legitimate thing to do. And it's very weird, isn't it, that you're suddenly not a real person. I mean, I suppose it's a sort of backhanded compliment that they think we're so... I don't know, successful or whatever, that we're sort of immune to. We just live in these sort of bubbles. It's totally silly. But I do think that Twitter has made you realise quite how many annoying people there are
delicately
in the universe. But lovely people
across the UK, online and on DAB.
Talk Radio.
We have ways of making you talk.
The Paul Ross Full Set Breakfast. Weekday mornings from 6 on Talk Radio. Maximise your morning mojo.
I beg your pardon.
And get turned on to the new Fearless Breakfast Show that can't keep its mouth shut.
I'm Paul Ross. Join me from 6 on Talk Radio. If it's on your mind, get it on the radio. The big new station for the whole of the UK, you lucky people.
Supercharged radio that demands a reaction.
Plug in to Paul Ross and make your morning hum.
The Paul Ross Full Set Breakfast.
Weekday morning from 6
on Talk Radio. We'll get you talking. Uncut after hours conversation for the up all night generation. Late night Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We have ways of making you talk.
We'll take calls straight to air after midnight. At the moment I'm chatting to author. Is there a difference between author and writer, Matt?
I always say writer. Yeah. I don't know why. Author just sounds a little bit little bit grand.
It does sound a bit grand. Listen, I've just started as well reading what's the title of it? The Last Family in England.
Oh yeah. Now
that was your first novel, was it?
Yes, it was. I wrote it years and years and years ago.
It's a cracking read. It's about I've not got far into it, so I don't want any spoilers, but Labrador's basically looking after humans is kind of the premise. When you got... Was that the first book that you'd written and it got accepted? Or had you written books before and sent off and got all the rejection slips? How did that work?
It was the first full book I'd written, but that book itself was rejected tons and tons and tons
really?
Of times. And yes, by you get rejected... you have two bouts of rejection as a writer. You get rejected by agents and then you get rejected by publishers. So it was sort of the last on my list. In terms of both, but I'm very slow. You know, books, it's incredibly slow.
Yeah.
It's like 2 years, you send it off, and then you know, 2 years later, you get the deal. But it was amazing because I wrote it in quite a sort of, well, still while I was in sort of a slow recovery from depression and all sorts of stuff was going on, and we were massively in debt and had all the normal kinds of real world sort of stuff going on. And I wrote this very, very silly story. And it was very nice that it got taken on. But it wasn't exactly instant riches or give up the day job or anything. But
no, I can imagine. But I was sat in my garden in the sunshine today reading it, and it made me chuckle a lot. Also, I've got to thank you for writing A Boy Called Christmas, because I have two young children, 6 and 4, two lads. And we read it over Christmas, and it's this is going to sound like I'm blowing smoke up the proverbial, but I genuinely believe, and maybe you know this, I genuinely believe you've written a classic. Do you know what I mean by that?
I don't know. It's nice to hear it, though, Ian.
Do you feel that? To me, it feels like a book that was written, you know, 20 years ago or 30. You know, it feels timeless, and it feels like a classic, and it feels like a book that I'm going to be getting out every year for the next 10 years, probably, to read to the boys.
Oh, that's very nice to hear, especially as I'm in the middle of editing the second one, the sequel to that. So I need that feel. But no, I all I know is I enjoyed writing that more than I've enjoyed writing any other thing I've ever written, I think.
Yeah.
It was just so nice. Especially, I've just written this very heavy autobiographical book about depression and dark grown-up stuff. And just to be able to escape into Christmas, even though I was writing it in the middle of the year, it was just so... Yeah, it was just like being eight again.
And it's got the best elements of the best kids' books in that it's actually quite dark and quite nasty.
Yeah, I think you have to have that.
You do.
That was me aiming for sweets, but yes, I know. There's death and it's a sort of balance. There's some reindeer pooing.
But kids love that. Kids love, you know, the Roald Dahl books are horrible, but they're gripping.
Yes, and the evil characters are the most fun to write as well.
Yeah.
Because often in a sort of grown-up novel, you have to have some sort of subtlety and contradiction in a character. But with kids' books, you can just go downright nasty. You don't have to have, why were they nasty?
Yeah.
You can just have a very evil aunt who just is an evil aunt, and that's fun.
It must have been a thrill, because I saw on Twitter loads of kids dressed up as characters from it for World Book Day.
Yeah, that was nice. Especially as World Book Day is nowhere near Christmas, so it was quite good. I mean, that's the weird thing, right, about a Christmas book. It's sort of like goes quiet for the rest of the year, so it was quite nice to see that popping up. That was one of the joys of Twitter. I feel like I was a bit too pessimistic about Twitter earlier. Yeah, that was quite nice.
Yeah.
The
book that I think is perhaps, well, I don't know if it has, you can correct me if not, but it seems to have got you the most attention recently is The Reasons to Stay Alive.
Yes.
Which is it's weird because you can read it in a day, and it's not a self-help book as such. It's kind of your account of having crippling depression and wanting to kill yourself. There's a bit where you're standing on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. When I first became ill, I was in a very terrible state. And I wrote this book not as someone having all the answers. You know, I go through bouts of anxiety and depression, you know, at various points. I've probably had about 20 bouts of anxiety and depression in my life, and I'm not in some perfect place. I'm a lot better than I used to be. But I just wanted to write a book that was slightly optimistic about it, you know, because if you're suffering from depression, you're getting a very, very negative outlook on life, which is wrong a lot of the time, you know, the thoughts you're having. So I wanted to try and cut through that and say, yes, depression is this miserable, appalling sort of 24-hour thing that, you know, 24/7, horrible thing. But actually, to try and separate yourself from the illness, and try and find some words that could have got to me at 24 when I was in Spain, when I was on, you know, a clifftop, very nearly took my own life. And just to what, I don't know if it would have worked, but just to try and see if there were any words that you could say to someone in that state. That was the first reason for writing. The second one was, you know, I just want people to understand what these invisible things feel like, because I think it actually helps people to be there for people if they actually know a little bit about what it's like.
Yeah, because someone who suffers from depression, it's hard for me. But I'm also acutely aware, perhaps over-acutely aware, that it's really tough for the people around me because they don't know what to do. And sometimes there is the attitude, oh, for goodness sakes, come on, just get up. But they don't know how to... It's not obvious, like someone's got a broken leg or, you know, someone's had chemo or something. It's not an obvious thing. You can look fine, but what is it? How you describe it? Your head's on fire.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can have very physical symptoms with it. I think one of the things I want to sort of like try and get, would love society to get to a point where we can talk about mental health in exactly the same way we talk about physical health, and actually to see it as part of the same thing. It's all health, And, you know, like physical illnesses can have mental effects. You can, if you've got a very high fever, you can be, you know, tripping and hallucinating and all of that. And a lot of the symptoms, because anxiety is my main thing. I mean, depression is part of that as well. But, you know, like something like anxiety, you know, so many of the symptoms are below the neck symptoms, you know, heart palpitations, sweating, lethargy, aching limbs, all of that. So, I think we've kind of got the wrong view where we see sort of mental health as this other thing, this other sort of scary sphere. And it's all integrated. It's all health.
Yeah, it's going back to something you said earlier on, your head lies to you. You know, and I've been suicidal, and it's weird. When I say suicidal, I don't mean I'm sat there with a bottle of pills or, you know, razor blades or something going, I'm going to do it. It's more of a belief that everything will be better if I didn't exist, and that I simply want to disappear and not be anymore.
Mm. Yes. And with me, what happened with me is I just felt trapped. And also, I think what's particularly dangerous is the first time people experience this, because it doesn't, the symptoms don't get particularly any better if you're having depression at whatever stage you are in life. But the very first time, when you don't even know what it is, you haven't necessarily had it diagnosed. I think that's the very scary, dangerous thing. And it certainly was in my case, because I just thought, oh no, this is my life. I'm going to be stuck in this moment forever. And, you know, I was 24 then, so I saw this sort of long life ahead of me, feeling utterly terrible. And I thought, oh my goodness, I can't do this. I've got to end it. You know, it wasn't that the fear of death was any less. It's just that life is suddenly this terrible thing. But obviously, even if you are a depressive kind of person, you don't stay at that state.
Yeah.
You don't stay at the very bottom of the valley the whole time, and it can very often be quite hard to hold on. But, you know, the point of reason to stay alive is just to try and see that sort of bigger perspective.
How did you cope with, I imagine, I wrote a blog, right, maybe about 6 months before your book came out, about my depression. And when I write a blog, it gets about 600-700 hits. I got about 30,000 hits in 3 days.
Yeah.
And I had 250 emails from people saying, thank you so much, my son killed himself. Or my wife suffers from this, and I don't know what to do. Or I've lost jobs from this. I had 250 emails, and I had like Jeremy Vine show wanting me to go on and stuff like that. And I kind of backed down, and I was literally overwhelmed by the emails I was getting. And I made a conscious decision: I can't reply to all of these because it's gonna drive me nuts. You know, I'm gonna pulled down. I imagine you had that on a much much bigger scale. Did you? And how did you deal with that?
I did. And I dealt with it by writing a Christmas book.
There we go. Fantastic. Yeah, Matt, honestly, thank you for that. Thank you for the humans. Thank you for all of it. And Boy Called Christmas, you've made my kids laugh so much. So thank you so much for that.
And thank you. And thank you for the way you just conducted yourself this year. And also for being so open about your own troubles and stuff. And I think I'm glad you found a great new home.
Thank you, mate. Nice to talk to you, Matt. Take care.
Cheers, Ian.
Thank you very much indeed. I'll tweet a link to Reasons to Stay Alive in a second at Ian Lee if you want to follow me. And also, A Boy Called Christmas. It's just, you read it to your girls, didn't you, Kath? It's just, don't worry, we haven't got time. It's just a joy. I was sending it to my family. I sent it to the kids in New Zealand. It's just a joy.
Oh, and you've got Matt Haig as well.
I know, we just listened to him.
Oh.
You left the too big. I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to add that onto the end of the opening
cool.
link.
It's cool.
But you left too big a gap. This is the closing link now.
I was just trying something different.
People will know that we've had Matt Haig because they've just listened to him. Unless he was really awful, in which case he won't make the edit. That is possible. Mm. I like to put all the guests in, and all of them so far this week, Dennis LeCourier from Dr. Hook, Andy Partridge, John Sebastian, Stephen Page, they've all been excellent. I don't know, maybe Matt's going to come a cropper. We just don't know. We just don't know. I've only met him once briefly before, 3 minutes, in, I'm going to say a Waterstones.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
And that went well, or...?
It was nice. I was a little bit starstruck. So, if you've heard him, beautiful. If you haven't, let's not
talk about it.
Let's not dwell on it. Let's not dwell on it.
Not his fault. He's not a broadcaster. He's a writer.
Well, but he's done a lot of interviews before now. So
he should have known better.
He should have known better. Oh, no, don't. Because if he listens, he'll think, oh, there was... Oh, I'm on the podcast. I'm going to listen to the, I'll get my family to listen to the podcast. And then at the end, all his family go, but A, you're not in it. And B, they're slagging you off. What's going on here, Matt? And it's going to be awkward on Twitter.
Yeah.
So let's just assume...
It was very good.
Let's assume that we forgot to press record and play, and that's why he's not in the podcast.
If he isn't. If he is, hooray. Ignore that.
Ignore all of this is irrelevant. It's pure fantasy. Until next week, ta-ta.
The radio show for people who know the best part of the day is the night.
Late Night Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We have ways of making you talk.